Hello and welcome to episode 24 of Making a Killing, a podcast from Hudson Institute's Kleptocracy Initiative on how corruption is reshaping global politics. I'm Nate Sibley, and with Paul Massaro, your host for today's episode, as Casey Michelle is travelling this week. No prizes for guessing the subject of this week's podcast, because unless you've been living under a rock, the release of the Pandora Papers has dominated headlines all around the world. It's not often that stories involving alleged transnational corruption and kleptocracy hit the mainstream like this, so we've been very busy, and we have a great show for you today. Joining us today is Miranda Petrusic, who is a deputy editor-in-chief at the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, which is a brilliant and brave investigative news outlet in its own right, but also part of the international consortium of investigative journalists that broke the Pandora Papers. Miranda herself has worked not only on the Pandora Papers, but the Panama Papers, the Paradise Papers, and the FinCEN files, as well as other investigations that exposed billions of dollars in suspicious funds. She takes us right inside the Pandora Papers to learn how these investigations work. It is a fascinating process and a really interesting discussion, so I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. But we also have some breaking news on today's podcast, as the Pandora Papers have also prompted a major reaction in the US Congress that could change the face of anti-money laundering, not only in this country, but globally. Our very own Paul Massaro, as you know, is a congressional staffer in his day job and has been involved in bringing forward what is known as the Enablers Act, which is due to be introduced shortly, if it hasn't been already by the time the podcast drops. And what this would do is extend the US anti-money laundering system beyond traditional banks to include lawyers and accountants and other professions who are routinely implicated in transnational corruption and other forms of illicit finance. We can't and we don't endorse legislation on this podcast, but it is a policy shift that we talk about a lot. So a really exciting development, sort of akin to the banning of anonymous shell companies early this year. And we'll be diving a bit deeper into that later on in the podcast with Paul as well. But that's enough for me. Let's go across and hear more about the Pandora Papers with Miranda and Paul. Okay, well, hello, everyone. I'm joined here, as mentioned in the introduction, by Miranda Petrusic and Paul Massaro, as always. And we're going to be talking about the Pandora Papers, on which Miranda has been working as an OCCRP journalist for the past few weeks and months. So, Miranda, maybe you could kick us off by telling us a bit about your work at OCCRP. What is OCCRP? What do you do? And what was it? What was your organization's relationship to the Pandora Papers?
Thank you very much for having me. Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project is a worldwide network of independent media centers and journalists. We currently operate on every continent of the world, and we are very proud of it. And what we do is basically we bring together journalists and editors and researchers and our tech team, and we are able to join our forces and work together to produce kick-ass investigations. So OCCRP was part of Pandora Papers, and I'm extremely proud of that. It's a brilliant project that I think will change the world. I personally was covering Caucasus and Central Asia, and I have to say that those are two of the my favorite regions, and obviously very corrupt and very interesting to report in. And Pandora Papers was really amazing in terms of the amount of information and kind of stories we got by looking at the data. As you can imagine, in the places where corruption is prevalent, and you know they're run by dictators and very corrupt leaders, being able to see what they're doing behind the scene is extremely interesting. And we found basically their footprints all over the data.
Amazing. Can you zooming back a bit from the Pandora Papers to the sort of broader, this sort of new model, relatively new model, sort of pioneered with the Panama Papers back in 2016 of collaborative journalism? Because OCCRP does this itself, but it also does it as part of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists on these bigger sort of things like the Pandora Papers. Could you just tell us a bit about, you know, like what it's like to work with other, because this is very unusual and new, isn't it? Usually newsrooms are very, very just sort of jealously guard their stories, and journalists sort of don't, they're like cats, they don't really sort of work very well together. But this has totally changed the way that we learn about kleptocracy and corruption, as you just mentioned. Could you just talk to us a bit about this amazing new model, which is sort of you know, to my mind, the sort of counterpart, the way that we counter the sort of transnational networks of kleptocrats who work together with like lawyers and enablers. We now have journalists working together across borders. But I'm sort of answering the question for you. But could you tell us a bit about what it's like to work in these collaborations?
Journalists are actually raised to be lone wolves. I mean, that's what you kind of are raised from the very beginning. You know, you're on your own. You're getting the records. You're talking to people, and you're producing a story. And the new model is really a radical change, and it's basically based on radical sharing, which means that you accept that everything you get is not yours. It basically becomes something that is used for everybody, by everybody in the team. So this radical sharing means that I will be interviewing somebody, I'll be going through the records, and I will be sharing all my findings. And that's what, you know, ICJ and, you know, both Panama Papers and now Pandora Papers model have been built on. It's built on ICJ obtaining records and basically sharing it with, in this case, 600 people. And these 600 people have worked together, have been looking through the leads, have been sharing leads even in the places where the, you know, which they're not covering. So, for example, if I was to come across information in Montenegro, I would be telling everybody else, well, here what I found, and maybe somebody in Montenegro would be interested in. What it also does, it basically empowers us as reporters to be able to follow our stories globally. And this is a part which is very difficult when, you know, when it comes to law enforcement. You know, when they investigate corruption, what happens is the moment it gets to the border, whether it's a physical border or if it's, a legal border, they will stop. And they might ask for assistance from another jurisdictions, but in more cases than yes, they will not. And what it means is it's very difficult for law enforcement to investigate cross-border and transnational corruption. For us as reporter, what it means is that, you know, I can get to some point and my colleague in another country will be able to go and give me the information I need about the people I'm investigating. And together we can uncover the truth, and together we can publish a story in both places where the, you know, crime is taking place. And that way our impact is much, much, much bigger and much, much stronger. So, you know, the model we had with this project, with Pandora Papers, was literally we got, you know, 11.9 million files, records. I mean, it's incredible amount. I mean, imagine as a human, how long it would take you to, you know, just I mean, it would take you probably, I don't know how many lifetimes. You know, I'll give you one example is, you know, in this project I was working on Azerbaijan, and, you know, we were going through, we had 84 companies which were linked with Aliyev family, the ruling family in Azerbaijan, and two of their associates. So one of these companies, just to go through it on my own, would take me sometimes a couple of days. You know, if I spent a year just doing this one story, I would still not be done. And that's where you really needed the power of joining forces with other reporters and working together and seeing what you don't see. So in this case, you basically had, you know, 10 reporters who were interested in Azerbaijan, and they were looking at it from different angles and basically coming up with the leads that you would never think of as a journalist. And ultimately that resulted in, you know, much bigger story than any of us could get on our own.
No, it's an incredible model. As I just mentioned, as you've made very clear, I really see this as the kind of, in addition to sort of increasing, you know, resources for law enforcement, improving the anti-money laundering system, supporting, you know, these transnational journalism networks, which are the direct sort of counterpart to transnational kleptocracy networks. It's, you need a network to sort of uncover and defeat a network, don't you? And it's just incredible work that you're all doing. And it's made the biggest difference to the way that we understand how illicit money moves around the world. It's just absolutely revolutionary what's happened since 2016.
That is very true. You need a network to fight the network. And without a network, you really cannot fight the network, because no reporter has resources, time, and even the knowledge or understanding of something to work on their own to expose the major crime network. You really do need, many reporters who can help you and who can basically help, provide information, work with you to basically, uncover a major corruption. And if you think about it, the resources that corrupt and, criminals have, I mean, we're talking, you mentioned it, it's the army of accountants, it's army of lawyers, it's an army of, offshore services providers, it's the army of PR people. I mean, and it's millions of dollars. And, you as a journalist, we are poor, we don't really receive a lot of money, we have very, thin resources to deal with. Yet where our power comes is from dedication and basically sheer number of us who are willing to, look into certain aspects of criminality or into, a certain person and the way that they are, acquiring a wealth illegally.
Just before we move on to some of the sort of the stories that you worked on, as I talk about those, you mentioned the Azerbaijan, the 700 million through London property already. We'll talk about that a bit more in a minute. But I just want a sort of sense of, because the scale of this is staggering, as you said, millions and millions of documents, 600 journalists. What is it like as a journalist working on one of these big collaborative leaks projects? I don't know how much you can sort of give away without giving, too much away about how you investigate these things. But so you get an email from ICIJ saying someone's got a big leak. Here's like a million files. You get going and tell us, and start working with it. Where on earth do you start with this? Do you start by trying to find, do you sort of do searches for persons of interest? So would you start by trying to find like the name of the Azeri president? Or do you just simply sort of like get stuck in and see where it leads you? What's the process when you're trying to sort of move through one of these investigations?
What first happens when you get a call like this from ICJ, it's your jaw drops and it takes you a few days to recover from just the sheer idea that you have this kind of pot of gold in your hands.
Yeah.
So that's one. But then once you start, the thing is, we always have this, and I'll put it in the quotation marks, regular suspects. Because one thing we've seen is once the person gets into the offshore world, it usually does not stop at the one company, and it usually does not stop with one registration agent. So, you can just assume that their footprint will be global and that they will pop up, somewhere, with another leak in another set of documents. So, some of these, rulers and some of these people are basically, they're just gifts that keep giving. And this was the case in this case. So, we had a group of regular suspects, people who, somehow by default always show up in our project. And I have to say, the Alia family has been, we wrote about them in the Panama Papers, and then they happen to show up here. And it's interesting, some of the companies we've seen here, actually we've seen through some other investigations. So this was just a continuation of that. So once we go through our regular suspect, then we do something that is not as exciting. You basically, write, for example, term Azerbaijan, or you write Kazakhstan, and suddenly you see, wow, there are 16,000 hits, and you're like, oh my God, that's going to take me a few months to go through, pretty much. And that's basically what happens. So you basically, wake up every day, and, you log in, and, get on the platform, and you start looking through the stuff you find. And, in some cases, you see a lot of reports that are not that interesting. In other cases, you suddenly come across, beneficial ownership declaration, and you're like, oh my God, this person is behind this company, and this company owns a huge property in London. And you're like, wow. In other cases, you see, a series of random names. We call them proxies, who show up as directors or shareholders of a well-known company, which, just won like a massive contract, for example, in, Kyrgyzstan, or a company which owns, construction company in, Tajikistan, or, you know, owns a famous real estate in London, and you're like, oh, who are these people? I've never heard of them before, but they're worth looking. So that's how it kind of starts. And, you know, obviously, you know, if you're interested in specific topics, you would be, you know, searching by keywords. So you would say, let's say BVI and UBO form. And you might find, you know, everybody, you know, every UBO form that is filed in the British Virgin Islands. So some of the searches are, you know, much more exciting, and you get, you know, many different things. But what I have to say is that, you know, after so many months and working on this project, I still feel like, you know, we probably haven't gone through, you know, 10% of the data. It really feels like, you know, every time I'm there and every time I'm searching for something, I, you know, I find something new. And, you know, it feels like I could spend my lifetime just working on the stories from this lake, and I still wouldn't be done. So it tells you how big it is. It also speaks of the use of offshore providers, and that, you know, when we think about it, it's not, you know, if you as a journalist could do so many stories from this kind of lake, imagine how much wrongdoing it is in this data. And, you know, what we published this week is, you know, just the surface, and there's so much more we could uncover.
Well, that's a good, I was going to ask this towards the end, but it's a good, anyway, is this the sort of, again, we'll talk about some of the work, the specific cases you worked on, but is this an ongoing, you know, we had a big drop over the weekend, stories are coming out sort of every day now, this week, from various outlets around the world, relating to different sort of corrupt officials or corrupt businessmen or whoever. Is this week kind of it for the Pandora Papers, or is this just going to keep going? You mentioned there is so much more in there that, you know, if you had time and resources, you would keep digging around. Presumably there's a lot more to come out. At what point do you choose to, does ICIJ and OCCRP and others choose to sort of publish the story rather than keep going sifting until you get through all 11.5 million files?
Well, you know, these projects are so big that really you could spend forever reporting them. But usually, very often, a few months from the beginning of the project, you kind of see what the big fish is. So, you know, immediately as you start, you know, literally within, you know, a day I received access to the leak, I saw that the leaves were in the data. So this was something where, and you know, within a few days, you know, we all realized how big, you know, how large number of companies that they have, they have established was. And, you know, obviously this was a story from day one. And also some of the other big stories that, you know, showed up in through the leak, you kind of recognize them from the day one. So in parallel to, you know, going through the leak and like basically finding new leads, at the same time, you start reporting the stories that you already have. And, you know, at some point you need to be thinking, okay, when do we publish? And usually, you know, halfway down the line, you know, like a few months after the beginning of the project, what we start to do is think about like, okay, what stories we have, you know, what, you know, should come out, you know, when can be published. And of course you have a summer break, then you have a winter break. So, you know, you can't do it over summer. You can't really do it over winter. And then what else is going on? You know, do we have another project? I mean, this year, you know, if we were considering publishing in summer, there was another big investigation that was coming out, the Pegasus project. You don't want to compete with that because, you know, you want time, and you want the timing to be right. So, you know, there could be intention. And then you have, you know, 600 partners and everybody has their own idea. You know, this is happening in this country and this is happening in that country. And, you know, there will be elections in Germany. Do you want to be publishing story in the midst of, you know, elections? There are, you know, there are all kinds of different considerations that partners have. And then, you know, ICIJ has a very difficult job to basically figure out, you know, give us a few options, like what kind of dates would work. And then basically it's, you know, the majority people agreement. And, you know, what I want, you know, this particular week to be when we publish the, you know, such a huge project. Well, I would love to have some more time. But then, you know, in another ways, like this is a, you know, this was great time because if we wait a few more weeks, we would be in winter. And, mm-hmm. you know, people would be getting ready for Christmas holidays. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the stories do continue. You know, me and my team, we already have more than a dozen stories lined up that we are continuing to work, and hopefully we'll publish in the coming weeks and months. And ICIJ will be releasing the database of with the names and companies, and that will only trigger even more investigations around the world, because then other reporters who had not had access to this data so far will be able to, will be able to find new leads. And, I have to say, like, even, it's been 5 years after the Panama Papers, this year we ended up publishing one story which also had the data from Panama Papers. And, as a journalist, if you think about it, there's only so many people we know and so many kind of like corrupt deals we know that we look into. But then, sometimes down the line, you hear about a company that was involved in something and you're like, oh, does this company show up somewhere here? And you're like, wow, it does. And it gives you a whole new perspective that you never knew about, from, a long time ago when you first started looking into the data. So, these leaks, and in general, like, as a journalist, the laundromat data we have collected over the years and, released in several major investigations still play a major role in our stories. When we first investigated the Azerbaijani laundromat or Troika laundromat or Russian laundromat, we saw, for example, some of the companies connected with Aliyev Associates in the data, but we never knew they belonged to them. So it took a leak like this to, connect what we knew from years ago in a whole different light, and we did it. So as a journalist, you kind of like, over the years, you build a huge repository, and combined, that repository gives you new leads. So I'm sure 5 years down the line we'll still be publishing Pandora Paper stories.
the gift that keeps on giving.
Exactly.
Well, that leads us to, maybe we can talk about some of the stories that you worked on then. You've already mentioned, the President Aliyev and his family and close associates, and the President of Azerbaijan, previously covered in OCCRP investigations like the Azeri laundromat, about how they were moving money through London. But the amount of money that, he and his family and his friends are purported to have moved through London real estate, according to the Pandora Papers, is just astronomical compared to previous estimates, isn't it? Maybe you could start by talking about the Azerbaijan case, and then we can talk about other things that OCCRP worked on.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that, myself, I've been really surprised. We've done stories before. We've done stories in, Panama Papers. We've done stories, as part of Hatice Project, which was, when our colleagues and friend Hatice Ismailova was jailed in Azerbaijan, we kind of committed to, publish stories in her name to kind of pressure authorities to release her. At the time, we uncovered, several of the properties that the family had in London. Panama Papers gave us another one. But, I could never have dreamed that this would be the number and, the value of the properties that the family and, two of their close associates have acquired. 700 million is a, huge amount of money. It's inconceivable for myself, when I think about it. And then what's also surprising is that actually some of these, we saw in some cases that, for example, it wouldn't be one property. It would be like five properties in one building. And, sometimes you would wonder, like, why do they need five properties? Like, wouldn't just one penthouse be sufficient? And then, we also uncovered, for example, in one, development, again, three properties. And again, it makes you wonder, like, why do you need so much? So it almost feels like, there's a huge influx of money, which is then being used to park it in what is the safest thing, which is, real estate. And, in London, which is one of the, places in the world where the property prices keep going up. And there is a huge demand, and obviously that's affecting local people who find the prices unaffordable. We've also seen that, the family had and their associates had a number of commercial properties, which again was very surprising. I love the lead that my colleague did when he wrote our overview story, which was, one morning the tenants in the street woke up to a new landlord. He was 11-year-old, and indeed, you know, Liev's son, Heydar, he became an owner of a shelf company when he was just 11 years old, and you know, he had a major, you know, complex in Maddox Street in London. Which is really fascinating. And, you know, if
lucky
you think
boy.
About it, a very lucky boy.
I was getting a few pennies in pocket money when I was 11 years old, if I was lucky. But a shell company and a massive property portfolio in London, he's got a bright future ahead of him, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah, and then, you know, another surprising thing is if you think about, you know, we had here records of 84 companies. And I have to say, you know, I was very, you know, if those were mine companies, I would be very confused. I mean, you know, none of the names, they're all very random, you know, flip tag investments. Like, you know, how do you like, you know, what does it mean? Nothing. So yeah. Very random companies, all of them in British Virgin Island, all of them incorporated almost as offshore machine. Pum, pum, pum. You know, stamps, Aliyev daughter here, Aliyev daughter there, you know, associate here, associate there. It was very, very surprising. It was very surprising, but definitely, like, in the end, when you think about it, it's a huge wealth that belongs to a ruling family of Azerbaijan, the family that has been, you know, accused of, you know, corruption before. It has been, you know, said that, you know, they've been winning elections through, you know, fraud and all kinds of machinations. You know, it's a family from a country that has been, you know, becoming increasingly authoritarian, where journalists are jailed, where there is no freedom of speech, where there is no, you know, freedom of assembly. There's no right for people to protest. There's no opposition. You know, we've been seeing a massive crackdown. So the fact that they're moving their wealth to a place like London is, in one way, not surprising, but also it is shocking. It is shocking that London is hosting this family in such a way.
All right, and that's one of the sort of themes that keeps getting stronger with each of the subsequent big leaks is the role of lawyers, real estate professionals, you know, like PR firms, accountants, you know, these sort of professional enablers in the West. And it's just sort of changing our view of how corruption works in the world, which for decades, you know, we assumed that, you know, places in Africa are corrupt, you know, places in Southeast Asia are corrupt, Latin America, those are the corrupt places in the world. But they can't function. The corruption is transnational and it can't function without the support that is provided by, you know, it's not facilitating, it's incentivizing corruption. That actually, I've got a few more questions for you, Miranda. I hope we have time to get to them. But I just wanted to bring Paul in here because I see he's popped back up. Paul is in and out of the podcast today because news is sort of being made while we were recording. As I mentioned in the intro, Congress is formulating its response to the Pandora Papers. And Paul has, as you know, he is an adjunct fellow here at Hudson with the Kleptocracy Initiative, but his day job is as a policy advisor at the Helsinki Commission, where he works on kleptocracy issues, which is why he always gives us the congressional update every week. But we've got a really good update this week, haven't we, Paul? And very timely indeed. In fact, this might be one of the first sort of like, I know Politico has written about this, but otherwise what you're about to talk about is one of the first sort of mentions of what the US policy response is going to be to the Pandora Papers. So do you want to go ahead and tell us a bit about it?
I mean, I guess I first just, I know that this has probably already been said and I've been away from a computer, but the work of ICIJ here is really invaluable. I mean, it's hard to express, like, as a very proud government official, as a very proud staffer for the US Congress, and as a very proud American, I am ashamed to say that the U.S. government has been very, very, very far behind on fighting kleptocracy, that scholars and academia have been very far behind, don't really understand how this whole thing works. Nobody seems to, except for investigative journalists. They really are like, when the Pandora Papers, you know, dropped on Sunday, it was just nuts to watch it. I mean, it was just incredible because although we all suspected this was happening, you know, to see it, to actually see the evidence, to understand it, is a completely different game. So, I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that it is the Pandora Papers that opened the policy window for what may be the most important national security measure in decades. I mean, certainly on the level of beneficial ownership transparency. And that is the Enablers Act, which will soon be introduced, or actually by the time of this podcast, well, it won't have been introduced, but it'll have been announced. But in any case, the Establishing New Authorities for Businesses Laundering and Enabling Risks to Security Act, the Enablers Act.
These acronyms in Congress are coming out with, especially on the kleptocracy side, are just totally out of control, Paul.
We have fun.
I don't know
how
long it takes to come up with these things, but we probably have solved all the kleptocracy stuff by now if you spent less time coming up with acronyms and more time passing laws. But please tell us what it does. Go ahead, please.
Yes. Well. Look, as I've said before, you know, if you're not having a good time doing this stuff, then it's not sustainable. So it's really important that you wear your Aloha shirt and have your whiskey and all that kind of stuff too. So and think up your crazy acronyms. So in any case, I mean, what this bill does is it implements a very, very, very long overdue reform in the USA, and that is to enable the Treasury to create very basic due diligence rules for gatekeeper professions. So right now, if you want a bank in the USA and your money is suspected to be dirty in some way, you know, or suspicious even, or whatever, a bank's got to do basic due diligence on you, on the source of your funds. This can be as simple as just asking if they're the proceeds of a crime or something. I mean, think about that. Like, America's lawyers, who, again, the incredible work of the ICIJ and the many other investigative journalists and independent journalists that are part of this, and, reveal that Baker McKenzie, for example, the U.S.'s largest law firm, was behind setting up this massive illicit, you know, economy, basically, and helping to move all these funds and everything else. And they never were under any obligation, whatever, under U.S. law, right, to ask if these funds were the proceeds of a crime. Like literally just that very, very basic thing. There is no law in place for that. So, I mean, but you look all over these stories, and how did this money get to the USA? It came through enablers. It's all about the enablers, baby. It's the enablers of kleptocracy. We're talking about lawyers. We're talking about art dealers. We're talking about real estate professionals. We're talking about company and trust formation agents. Like, I mean, of course, you know, like, okay, Dakota's offering all these insanity, you know, perpetual trusts, anonymous trusts. You're the beneficiary of your own trust. I mean, like, give me a break. Like, what could you imagine? Like you're a beneficiary of your own, so I mean, it's just completely outrageous, but somebody's doing that. Somebody's
Because he's not here to speak for himself, Paul, I will just direct listeners, because they may not be aware of the sort of trusts issue. If you don't understand this came out in the Pandora papers, yeah, particularly the role of the U.S. trust providers industry in facilitating sort of very suspicious sort of transactions, holding suspicious money right in the American heartland, hundreds of millions of dollars from suspicious sources. And Casey, who can't join us today, he's at a conference, wrote a really good article about this. I think it was in The Atlantic. Uh-huh. How South Dakota became the next Cayman Islands. And that will set you up. And also, of course, read the Pandora Papers story about this, which I think was in the Washington Post. Unless you're living under a rock, it will be a simple sort of Google search away. But the role of trust is really important. It's right up there with anonymous shell companies. But sorry, Paul, I interjected just in case the audience didn't know what we were on about.
It's really important because I get off on this stuff. But I mean, being able to express it in ways that, you know, people can easily understand is just so critical, because this is the game. I mean, if you want to understand why democracy is in retreat, why our politics are a mess, why everything just seems like it's on fire, I mean, it's because of these massive, massive, massive illicit financial flows. I mean, these are they're all going the same way. You know, I've seen a lot of people speculate as to why Americans or Western Europeans or whatever aren't included. Well, I mean, to me, it was obvious, right? Because the money is going from dictatorships and struggling democracies and so on and so forth to the West. The West are the enablers. The East is where the dictators, the kleptocracies are. So that's where the money's being stolen. So it's being stolen, and then it's laundered, and then the enablers help it to come into the West. So what we're doing with this bill, the Enablers Act, is finally putting basic due diligence on these enabling professions. Basic stuff, you know? And for most people, this won't matter at all. For most people in these professions, no big deal, you know? Because really, the individuals that are getting up to the insanity, you know, bringing $10 million in cash or whatever in a suitcase or something like that, you know, those are just a handful of people, right? So, I mean, it's the big law firms that work for those. It's the whatever. Those are the ones that are going to need to be a little bit more cautious. And in, I mean, and only at the most basic level, because as I've said before, everybody knows what they're doing. There's no such thing as an enabler that doesn't know exactly what they're doing. So now we're going to make it so that they actually have to ask the question.
When you say basic, because I imagine, you know, not that I think people who own sort of little junk shop, and which are strictly, you know, might be legally antiquities shops out in Idaho or something, probably listen much to this kind of podcast. I hope I'm wrong. But, you know, if I were the owner of a small business and suddenly I heard I was going to have to do due diligence on, like, you know, I have to set up, what, do I have to set up a compliance department? I'm a self-employed guy. I make $30,000 a year. I have a little shop on the corner where I sell little bits of old junk. And I live nowhere near the international art markets or anything. I'd be absolutely sort of terrified that this is a huge new government regulation coming down the line, and I just don't need it. I've just come out of the COVID crisis. I'm trying to, you know, I'm trying to get back on my feet. You know, like what practically, maybe like two examples. What will this involve for that kind of, you know, mom and pop shop who happens to be within that kind of sector? Will they have to set up huge compliance departments and start filing things with the Treasury every 5 minutes? And then maybe at the other end of the scale, these big law firms, will they have to do that? What will the sort of, how do you envisage the balance will be? And how do we avoid placing sort of burdens on businesses in that way?
It could be as simple as if there's a suspicious, like somebody's coming to you with $10 million in cash, you know. I always think of that Global Witness investigation, right? They go to 13 law firms, and 12 of 13, including the president of the ABA, the American Bar Association at the time, you know, basically doesn't like, they look like they're like hardcore suspicious. You know, I'm an African minister that got all this money from somewhere, and where did it come from, and yada, 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 you know, and they don't ask any questions. They basically jump right to, oh yeah, we can help you get that in there. We'd set up the shell company and then this trust and blah, 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 and it'd all be anonymous and whatever, you know? So it could be as simple as, if it's suspicious, you have to ask if they were the proceeds of the crime. Because what this is about, right, what due diligence is ultimately about is setting up tripwires, right? Like, how do you catch criminals? That's kind of like when it comes down to it, like, how do we know stuff happens? Well, you set up tripwires. You start getting to the point where they're lying, or they have to fill out a form, or they have to do this or that or the other thing, right? And then the criminals eventually screw up. And when they screw up, we catch that. And then we can build a whole investigation off that. So it's amazing to think. It really is amazing to think. But having a lawyer, a real estate professional that's about to sell a luxury penthouse in New York City or whatever, right, ask someone that's spending $10 million in cash, is this the proceeds of a crime? Like, is enormous. It's an enormous, enormous thing. Because the other thing it might do, I mean, if they lie, great, then we can get them on that. But if they just exit the transaction altogether, also good. You know, like it also, like, I mean, at the end of the day, we want to catch the criminals, but it's also about keeping the dirty money out of our economy in the first place, right? I mean, at the end of the day, we have to purge all kleptocratic cash from the United States and from the West. That's the only way that anything changes, is by forcing the kleptocrats to live and sleep in the bed that they've made, to have to hold their money, right, in the repressive societies that they've created. And then eventually, because they can't just come to the West and enjoy the rights that they deny their own people at home, right, then eventually they will demand change. And that's when you finally start seeing the rule of law appear, right? And that's also the reason that it doesn't appear in these places, because they can just go abroad and enjoy all the rule of law they want abroad right now.
That's fantastic. Thanks, Paul. So, Miranda, if you're still there with us, I wonder if you what your reaction is to this. You know, when we talk about the role of professional enablers, almost everything we were talking about when you were investigating this involves one of these sort of professional these professions that keep coming up and again. I know you're an investigative journalist. You might not be able to sort of offer analysis of such, but like, what is your reaction to this idea that the US might be starting to move towards closing some of these loopholes? Would that make it more difficult for people to do the kinds of things that we've been seeing in the Pandora Papers?
I would say it's a long overdue. So congrats to US for finally taking this important step. It's also very exciting. I mean, one thing we've seen, you know, as a change compared to, you know, Panama Papers was in this leak. You know, a large number of files we were able to see were basically, you know, files with UBO, ultimate beneficial owner information disclosed, which, you know, previously we have not seen so regularly. And part of it was change in the legal requirements and obligation that these, you know, providers had. In this case, you know, not saying that we will have a leak of, you know, a major law firm, but the fact that this will be required will be a major step forward. And also it will be, you know, they will not be able to justify, well, we didn't know. You know, in this case, you would ask and, you know, it will be your responsibility if you didn't know. So I think it's a major step forward. It's really huge. And congrats to US. And I think, you know, hopefully, you know, some of it will at some point become public, which would be the next step. And I hope, you know, that will be a step, a future step that US will take. But, you know, it's important that US is taking a lead and taking an important role in basically holding enablers accountable.
Which is, you know, it's... Which is a sort of a note of caution. It took us sort of 10 years to get the anonymous ownership of shell companies banned in the US. So I hope it doesn't take anywhere near as long for us to take this very simple other step, which of course is also, I'll bring it just a second, but like one of the important things to remember about this, it's not a sort of fringe radical thing that, you know, a bunch of left-wing, you know, investigative journalists who want to kind of impose radical transparency on everyone is bringing forward. This is something that the US signed up for decades ago through the Financial Action Task Force. There's a bunch of standards. This is the Global Anti-Money Laundering Watchdog. And every time it assesses the US for its anti-money laundering things against standards that the US has signed up to uphold, it finds two major vulnerabilities. One is the anonymous ownership of shell companies, which is so often abused for money laundering, as we've heard ad nauseum on this podcast. We acted to fix that on January 1st this year. The other major vulnerability is the narrow scope of the anti-money laundering regime. And if this Enablers Act, if it goes forward, which I personally hope it does, we're not allowed to endorse legislation, but this is so straightforward and obvious, I can't think how else to phrase it, frankly. That is the other major vulnerability, as identified by the Global Anti-Money Laundering Watchdog, that the US has, and that is a standard that the US has committed to internationally. Paul, you had your finger up. You wanted to add something else?
I want to, of course, support everything you just said. I think it's very important. This is FATF Recommendation 22, in fact, and you're exactly right. These are recommendations that the United States helped to build, right? I mean, this is all really basic stuff. There's nothing crazy about anything here. And I guess the other thing I want to say is, you know, the political environment's very different than it was 10 or 20 years ago. And I think that's in part due to your excellent work, Nate, but also because of just the manner that the political environment, the international relations environment, has fundamentally changed. I mean, the president has now called countering corruption, you know, a core national security interest, has declared corruption a national security threat. There's a caucus against foreign corruption and kleptocracy in Congress. I mean, it's just, we have recognized that this is so much more than, oh, well, we don't want, you know, a regulation or whatever. Like it is the existential national security threat. It is behind every single other national security threat. You care about climate, you care about human trafficking, you care about counter China, you care about whatever, counter Russia, whatever, counter authoritarianism. All of it is corrupt networks. All of it is the ability to move dirty money into our country. All of it is being able to have access to the best legal minds in the world. Right? I mean, look, that's American law firms, right? These are the biggest global law firms in the world. I mean, come on, you know, like we've got to stop this. This is a national security threat, you know? So that's what this is about, you know, ultimately. This is democracy versus dictatorship. And if we want democracy to survive, then we've just got to take some very common sense measures to ensure that like all our best and brightest can't be bought off by dictators.
Well, there you go. That's a good way to put it. Miranda, did you have any... We've come to the end of our time at the podcast. It's been a real privilege to hear from someone who worked on the front lines of the Pandora Papers, but so many other of OCCRP and ICIJ's investigations as well. Did you have any just sort of final thoughts? You know, perhaps you could tell us, is there another Pandora... You know, you're running out of alliterative papers leaks now. So you've had the Panama Papers, the Paradise Papers, the Pandora Papers. So I don't know if you're able to do any more leaks because you'll run out of peas. But what's sort of coming next for OCCRP? I mean, you mentioned you've got more stories related to the Pandora Papers coming out. Do you have any just final thoughts on the Pandora Papers? Or the stuff Paul was talking about, the policy reactions you're hoping for in the US and around the world, and maybe like what's coming next from you guys?
We have more stories coming and obviously more projects and hopefully more collaborations. If, we basically get invited every year for, a number of projects where groups of journalists are gathering and working together. And I'm sure by the next year, you'll be hearing more about big global collaborations. In terms of stories, obviously, keep an eye on our website. There will be more stories coming from the Pandora Papers, but also in general, we keep publishing stories. Even in the middle of Pandora Papers, we've been publishing other investigations. I will also say that, we always welcome tips. So if somebody has more knowledge of the stuff we have exposed or some documents they would be willing to offer, please come our way. We'll be always interested to go back to our usual suspects and do some more investigations. And obviously, support us and share our stories because that's how we reach, more people, and that's how the change happens.
And donate. If you care about kleptocracy, you're listening to this podcast. Giving money to OCCRP is frankly one of the best things you can do right now, if not the best thing, because it is these stories that they churn out, the risks they personally take. We haven't even talked about that, but often your reporters put themselves at personal risk to do this stuff. It's worth supporting in every sense. Share it, but also chip in and support that work. It is the way that we will unravel global kleptocracy. On that note, though, we have run out of time. Miranda, as I said, it's been a privilege. Thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the rest of your stories coming out. Paul, thank you also for your time, because you're actually super busy this week with the policy response of the United States Congress to the Pandora Papers. And so it's goodbye for me, and goodbye to you both.
Thanks so much, Nate. Always a pleasure. See ya.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Making a Killing, the podcast from Hudson Institute's Kleptocracy Initiative on how corruption is reshaping global politics. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to subscribe and share with your friends. You can also give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. That really helps get the word around. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.